Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, December 4th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This is the last of several podcast intros that I'm recording from the road. I'm actually time traveling even more this time because I'm still in New Zealand while I record this. I'm about to leave Wellington. I'm going to stop off in Auckland for just a bit and then head on to Hong Kong and southern China. But for now, so that I can send my podcast equipment back on home, I'm going to go ahead and record the intro to this episode. And guys, it's going to be a really good one. But before I tell you who's on the show, I want to thank those of you who help support Talk Nerdy. And remember, there's a lot of ways to do it. But the whole point of this is that Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. It's because of listener support from people like you that people who can't afford to support the show will still be able to listen to it for free. My top patrons this week include Phil Tiber, Timothy Glover, Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, Christian Jeffrey, Stuart Oag, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Now, if you want to hear your name called out on the show, all you've got to do is go to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support. And remember, another great way to support the show now that it's the holiday season is to shop in the Talk Nerdy store. If you go to my website, carasantamaria.com, and click through to the Talk Nerdy store, you will see that I still have a bunch of things for sale, but I'm about to move over to a new style of merch store. So I've got to sell out of everything I have right now. So I'm going to be doing a sale, it's active right now. I don't know why I said that in the future tense, probably because I'm time traveling. So just use the offer code NERDYHOLIDAY and you'll get 15% off of everything in the store. All right, guys, this week is a really good one because this week I get to finally air an episode that I've actually had recorded for quite some time. And the person that I got to chat with is just fascinating. I mean, top tier, really interesting, really kind of contributory, I think that's a word, professor. Her name is Dr. Anne Fausto Sterling, and she is a professor emeritus now at Brown University. She has published a lot in the field of biology of gender, sexual identity, gender identity, and gender roles. And I think a lot of the questions that you may have about these complicated and I think important to understand issues will be answered during this episode. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Anne Fausto Sterling. Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
So I'm really excited to tackle some of the topics on the podcast that you have, of course, been spending a career investigating and doing a lot of really wonderful, not just science, but science communication around these topics. So I first met you, met you digitally back when I was at the Huffington Post, one of my first jobs as a science reporter, trying to bring science to those pages. And we did a small video on sex and gender, and you helped enlighten me a little bit to, you know, some of the topics that we talked about in that video. It's since been, you know, a few years, and now I have a different platform, and I'm excited to double back and maybe, luckily, spend a little bit more time getting into the depths of this. So I guess to start, you are at Brown University?
I am, although I am officially retired, so I'm a professor emeritus now.
Congratulations.
Yes, it's wonderful.
That's great. And so, but you're obviously still doing work.
I'm writing in various venues, and I'm also just completing articles based on research that I did in the last decade that I was at Brown. So, and I can do all of that remotely. So it's really wonderful.
Yeah. That is wonderful. So you can spend time where you want to spend time, and you can
exactly.
Have a nice relaxing environment while you do it. Because writing can be very, very stressful. Obviously, it's a big part of any academic's career, but it's a lot of work.
There are stressful parts to it, but I also enjoy it. I especially enjoy writing the non-scientific articles. The scientific ones, it's such a constricted format. I don't enjoy that as much, but I enjoy data crunching. I mean, there's a real pleasure in that, sort of hunting through your data and seeing what it shows and having a hypothesis and seeing if the data support it or not. That's very intense and pleasurable.
I love that. I mean, I think that I hope at least that many scientists feel the same way. Some of them may not, but
maybe
you're right.
But I think a lot do. I think most of the stress in science comes from having to deal with funding all the time and frankly having to write in this terribly constricted format that scientific publication is.
Oh my gosh. I will tell you what, I am going back for my PhD and I've just started some.
Are
of
you
my
in what
work.
Field?
I am in psychology.
So good for you.
Thank you. I'm really excited. You know, I did about a year towards it in clinical neuropsych and I left and have been doing science communication full time, but I'm going back now. I think I'm going to focus in something different in psychology, but goodness, I've been doing popular science communication for 8 years and getting back into APA style and getting back into these like critical, oh my gosh, it's, yeah. You have to so unlearn things.
You do. And APA style, I can never get it right. I mean, I don't care about that kind of detail enough.
Mm-hmm,
you know, whether the period goes before the closed parentheses or the after, you know, luckily I often collaborate with people who just have it down and they do it for me or, you know, someone corrects me, but it's actually a frequent criticism of my papers by reviewers is that I haven't done the APA format properly. And I'm like, give me a break.
That's great. There's hope for us all if we're struggling with it while we're in school.
Right. Absolutely. But you'll learn it from the beginning and you'll just do it automatically, I'm sure.
Well, so the part that's frustrating for me, at least, and this is a little bit esoteric if you're, you know, not in these fields in academia, but I learned it all I was a psych undergrad and then I moved to biology for my master's and then I went back to psych. I'm going back to psych for my PhD. I learned it all as an undergrad. I have A, completely forgotten it. And B, the new publication manual has all these differences.
So you might as well forget it.
Exactly. It's like, thank you for
that. What school are you going to?
So there's a school out here in, it's actually in Santa Barbara. I live in Los Angeles. It's called Fielding. And the model is really interesting to me because, of course, I still do some work as a science communicator. And I'm, you know, in my mid-30s. So I didn't want to go to a traditional academic institution and start a PhD with a bunch of people that are 22,
living
at home
that.
With their parents, you know. So
right.
Fielding is, it has an approach, it's kind of for mid-career professionals. A lot of the people who decide to go there have already worked as counselors, have already worked as social workers, and now they want to get licensure. I think their average individual that goes there is like 34 years old, and they have a distributed learning model, much like many med schools do now. Yeah, so
I didn't know about them. That's great.
It's really cool. It's APA accredited. But there's no true campus. You have these sessions that you visit throughout the country, you know, maybe once or twice a year. You have cluster groups in your own community. And then you do a lot of your coursework by watching the lectures or engaging in the lectures through an online format and writing papers and submitting them. So
that's great.
Yeah, I'm really excited to get started. And I'm doing all of the orientation stuff right now, but I've already had to start writing. And I'm like, oh, God.
Great. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is that switching back and forth between a more open style of writing, which you do for the kind of science writing that you do and the academic writing, it's a challenge to make that switch.
And it almost feels like I feel a little dirty because I don't practice what I preach when I'm doing science communication teaching, you know, when I'm holding workshops and things, it's always like, don't use jargon. Don't try to sound so smart. You're going to turn people.
Right.
And then I'm sitting here writing this super dense paper using all of these really big
Absolutely.
Words.
Absolutely. Yep. I'm right with you.
So, all right. Speaking of that, you do this, you actually do the very academic, intense publication. You also are just a wonderful science communicator. And of course, your field is an interesting one because are you technically technically in a biology department? Was it psychology? Is it an interdisciplinary field?
Yeah, I was technically in a biology department. I was trained as a developmental biologist, developmental genetics. For many years, I basically taught embryology or developmental biology. But as I became more and more involved in gender studies, as sort of a natural outcome of my feminist activity and, you know, starting in the late 60s, I ended up moving into a field that was much more, had much more kinship with psychology, because people I worked with, people in the, you know, my colleagues in activist groups wanted to know, well, you know, what does biology do? And does biology really make men more aggressive? And those kinds of questions. And I found I had to, you know, educate myself about it, but I had the technical skills to go back and read all the original papers and figure out how to interpret things. And so I ended up moving. In a way, it's still the same. I study development. I ended up moving from, I started out studying the development of fruit fly embryos. And this last project that I'm doing, this sort of final decade and a half of my academic career, I'm studying human infancy. But the common theme is development. It's just an effort to look at development as a dynamic process rather than a static sort of moving from one rigid stage to another rigid stage kind of process.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned that sort of in the 60s when you were first becoming aware of the questions about gender identity and, you know, being engaged in feminist activism, that having these tools, these biological tools, these scientific tools to be able to go into the literature and start doing true experimental design, you know, hypothesis testing, that's really where those two things converged. And at the time, you must have been seeing an incredibly strong gender bias in the literature.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what my first book, Myths of Gender, really addressed that gender bias. And it addressed it somewhat historically and then reviewing the literature that was being used at the time. And it took all sorts of different levels. I mean, there was the, you know, there were sort of, in a way, rookie experimental methodological mistakes, like people would publish an article on testosterone in male rats and some effect of testosterone on their behavior. And then they would make a conclusion about sex differences, but they had no female rats in their study group. So they were reaching a conclusion about a difference between male and female based on only study of males. Yeah. And that is, so the literature was filled with stuff like that. And it took not only myself, but a number of feminist biologists who began writing critically at that time, Ruth Blyer, Ruth Hubbard, Ethel Toback. There were a whole bunch of people in the late 60s and early 70s doing this, who started calling out the field on these kinds of basic methodological problems.
And of course, now it's 2017, you know, it's 50 years later. And
I know. Don't tell me.
And although we've seen, I think, many improvements in the approaches to the science that's being done, I think that we've seen a real intense kind of intentional change in trying to, I don't know, to maintain equity in at least how we do our science. We're not there yet, but I do think
that's right.
We've seen leaps and bounds.
I agree with that. Yep.
I would say that, though, still sociologically, still within the popular culture, and even within kind of the quote-unquote hallowed walls of academia, there are major misunderstandings about gender, about sex, and there's still almost what's become a political pushback against the kind of true science that you do. Like, there's people that often conflate political viewpoints with scientific findings. One example that I would bring up, and I think it could kind of be the entree into maybe debunking some of these myths is that I've been lucky enough to work on Bill Nye Saves the World, which is a Netflix TV show. And we've just wrapped on season two. But on season one, there was an episode about gender, and it was a very evidence-based episode. And there was a song about how two genders is not enough. And there was so much blowback by a very specific sect of individuals who really criticized Bill and Bill's writing staff for politicizing science.
Right. Well, this is a hard time about this. I mean, this kind of thing came up also in the March for Science, where, and it's not exactly the same thing, but the organizers of the march were emphasized that good science required a diverse scientific workforce. And so they pushed for principles of diversity among scientists. And there were some scientists who argued that that was a negative thing for science to do that, because what you should do is that diversity didn't matter to science, and that science stood on, was sort of its own abstract purity, and that you were, again, politicizing the march. And of course, a march is political. That's,
that's, I mean, the point.
You can't get around that. But again, there was this internal fight about what science is and how it proceeds. And of course, really good science has internal struggles and disagreements, including how you frame a research problem. But at the same time, in this very moment, we're also, all of us, no matter where we are internally on that spectrum, we're fighting this much bigger fight of people who want to simply deny any kind of facticity in the world. You know, how do you keep having, I think, what is a positive and constructive struggle within science about these issues, while still defending science as a whole against, I think, a much more primitive attack from without? I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but that's, I think, is the same kind of thing that maybe you guys and Bill Nye, and I heard some criticisms of the Bill Nye thing from a listserv that I'm on, where, again, it was scientists attacking that episode, saying it was oversimplified and whatever.
Yeah, which is always the criticism of, science on TV, public communication of science. But
of course,
but you're right. I mean, I think another example of that would be climate science. It's probably one of the better examples. Climate science is super complicated, and there are internal conversations and arguments all the time about what does this finding specifically mean? How is this affecting the warming climate? At what rate is this changing? Can we tie this specific weather event to these trends in the data? Yet from the outside, people say, you guys don't agree. You must be wrong. It's like a logical fallacy where they're just throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
It is throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but I think more fundamentally, it represents a failure of all of us as educators, and maybe more broadly, it's not only on the shoulder of educators, to really do good science education from the ground up, I mean, from kindergarten up. So that I think people fundamentally don't understand how science works, and that don't understand, because there's been this tendency to teach, I think, particularly in elementary and grade school, there is a fact and it's true, or there's a fact and it's not true. And the idea that that you arrive at that truth is, in a way, it's an evidence-based consensus that involves a back and forth. And it always involves empirical findings and, you know, trying to the best of our ability to base what we think on the experiments and we've done and the facts, you know, the material that we've studied, but to understand that science is always a process and not just it's true or not. And I think we don't teach science as a process starting in elementary school, and people get this very rigid to the extent that they know anything about science, because I think our educational system here is so poor, that they get this idea that science is a place of absolute truth. And of course, scientists don't mostly think that. They know better because they watch truth get made, and they watch things that people believed was true within science become disproven at some, 20 years later with new evidence or new tools or
absolutely
whatever.
this conversation about a scientific approach to thinking, about skepticism, about critical thinking, it's kind of just missing from early education. And so what we end up doing is really heavily relying on authority and then becoming sometimes, I think, paranoid or conspiratorial when authority seems to let us down, because we're not peeling back the curtain and looking at the inner workings of why is that the authoritative view. You know, this children saying why and the answer being like, because I said so, I think is a fundamental, it's a problem. It's a real problem. I understand it as a shortcut. I'm not ever going to blame a parent who is exhausted and having a hard day.
If it's the 100th why in a row, exactly. You know, you're just, I do understand that.
Yeah, but ultimately, I mean, if a teacher ever says that to a child, that's really, really a problem.
Right, right. You know? I mean, I remember this. I was teaching freshman embryology, and it was probably 30 years ago or something. And I had this freshman in the class, and he was pre-med, and I shouldn't stereotype pre-med, but he was like very focused on getting the right answer so he could get the right grade to make his pre-med step. And he asked me, I don't remember what, a question about something in development. And I said, I don't know. And I said, worse than that, no one knows. The answer is not known. And he just couldn't deal with it. He was like, you have to know. There has to be an answer, you know. And I was like, no, the experiments haven't been done. People haven't been able to study that. Whatever it was some aspect. But he was just freaked out by the idea. He was only 18. I'm sure he matured more on that front, but cognitively he was like, couldn't deal with it.
That's so, not funny, but it's so, you know, it's so sad, because I think for a really scientifically oriented student who really enjoys the process of problem solving, what a teachable moment, right? What if like a, oh my gosh, I could answer that question one day.
That's right. That's right.
But instead, it's like my authority figures have failed me.
Exactly right. That's exactly what it was like.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah, and when I lecture now on the work I'm doing, and it's in a way, it's very preliminary work. It's an attempt to open up ways of studying gender and development. And people in the audience, and there's always a lot of students in the audience, say, ask me some question like, have you done, you know, your study only uses heterosexual families, what would happen if you use same-sex parent, a family with same-sex parents? And I'm like, what a great question. That's what you're going to do with your career for the next 30 years.
Exactly.
But because I'm done, you know, I'm not starting a brand new 30-year long project, because I'm, you know, I wouldn't be here to finish it. But it's absolutely right. For the students who really appreciate or are interested in the problem solving, it's getting those questions set up that they can then pursue themselves. That's great.
Yeah. And that's really, I think, inspirational to see. It gives me a lot of hope for the future, to see how many young people really are hungry and really, I think, are like almost better equipped to be able to take those problems on head on. Because, of course, I think that overwhelmingly, the arrow of time sort of bends to progress. So, you know, even though there are huge hiccups, we're in one politically now.
We're in a hiccup right now, but I agree with you. It's a hiccup.
It's a hiccup, yeah. And so, generally speaking, generation after generation after generation are coming in with, I think, less burden of preconceived notions, because we just know more than we used to know.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Morty, M-O-R-T-Y, the newest and smartest way to get a home mortgage. Now, I recently got a mortgage, and I can tell you that it was really time consuming, and it was probably not my favorite thing in the world to do. If I had had Morty, it would have been faster and much easier. They simplify the process and they help you find the smartest mortgage that's right for you. You get real loan options in minutes. You're never called or sold to by a mortgage broker. You can automatically generate a pre-approval letter online, and that helps you speed up the home buying process an awful lot. Morty also saves you money. There are no commission salespeople, so their experts exist solely to get you the best deal possible. And of course, if you ever get stuck or you have questions, which I know you will, someone from Morty's team is always ready to assist you over real-time chat or on the phone. So if you're a first-time home buyer looking to refi, or you're buying an investment property, head on over to trymorty.com/nerdy to get started today. That's TRYMORTY, trymorty.com/nerdy. And here's the fine print. Morty Inc. is a licensed mortgage broker, equal housing lender, www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org, number 1429243. Talk Nerdy is also sponsored by The Great Courses Plus. Guys, I love learning. You love learning. That's why this podcast works. And that's why you will love The Great Courses Plus. With their video and audio streaming service, I've got unlimited access to learn from award-winning professors and experts about over 8,500 different things. Science, history, math, languages, photography, anything you can think of. And you can watch their videos on a TV, a laptop, a tablet, or a smartphone. Or you can even now stream audio on the Great Courses Plus app so that you can listen while you're at the gym, while you're driving, all those places where you need to keep your eyes wide open. Guys, lately I've been listening to the course, The Theory of Everything, The Quest to Explain All Reality. It's taught by Dr. Don Lincoln from Fermilab. Yeah, that Fermilab. And he kind of goes to the basics from Newton to Einstein and then moves on to really this quest to develop a unified theory of everything and the places where different aspects of physics play really nice together and the places where we haven't yet figured out how to make them play nice together. There's so much to learn, and I want you to experience it. I want you to go to The Great Courses Plus, where they are offering my listeners a free month of unlimited access to enjoy all their courses, not just The Theory of Everything, all their courses. You've got to go, though, to this special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. And finally, this week, I would like to thank Blue Apron for their continued support of Talk Nerdy, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron is so easy and it's so delicious. Let me tell you how it works. You go online, you choose your meals. It is less than $10 per person per meal. And you get exactly what you need to cook a delicious home-cooked meal. And I'm talking everything you need, every single ingredient, perfectly portioned so you can't screw it up. A beautiful, full-color, step-by-step recipe card. And everything can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. It's amazing. So some meals that are coming up this week, actually next week, so you can look forward to them. You can get them in time, are sheet pan roasted pork with fall vegetables and creamy maple mustard sauce, chicken and paprika spiced rice with mustard pan sauce and collard greens, honey and miso glazed salmon with stir-fried udon noodles and bok choy, and of course, kale and ricotta cannelloni with roasted acorn squash. Oh my gosh, it smells, it tastes, it looks like winter around here. So guys, check out this week's menu. Get $30 off your first order with free shipping. All you've got to do is go to blueapron.com/nerdy. Once again, that's blueapron.com/nerdy.
I would love to talk about what we do know, because I think that this is an area of so much misconception. And even I myself, you know, I obviously have never studied this in any of my academic endeavors, and I probably have some real misconceptions that I'm living with. So I think the first and maybe most obvious question that I'd love to ask is just, what is sex and what is gender? How are they different? How are they related? What are we talking about when we use those two different terms?
Okay, I'm going to answer that, but I'm also going to say that in recent years, I and others, I'm not the only inventor of this, but there are a number of people who are now starting to write this way, have introduced a third term, and it's an awkward one, of course. It's called gender/sex or just gender sex.
Okay.
So, and I'll explain why that we need that third term if you're thinking dynamically about the body. So in psychology, when in the study of individual psychological development, in the 50s, really, a guy named John Money, who is famous and infamous, but did really important work in gender and development, introduced the notion of sex in the individual as having to do solely with the biological parts. So he would include chromosomes and hormones, and the hormones would be the hormones you made and the fetus makes, and also the hormones the adolescent makes and the adult. He included all of the genitalia, the internal organs, the external organs, all of those he called sex. And then he introduced the idea of individual gender identity as how one believed oneself to be as either a male or a female. A little bit later, completely different trend of thought used those same two terms, and that was introduced especially by an anthropologist named Gail Rubin, who published a paper, a little booklet in the mid-70s called The Traffic in Women, in which she introduced again the idea of sex as meaning something biological, and the idea of gender, in this case, she introduced it less as an individual characteristic and more as a social characteristic, a social structure. So, for example, a gendered social structure would be one which said, I'll give you an example from my 1950s high school. The boys were sent in school to take shop classes and the girls were sent to take home ec. So there you go. That's a gendered structure, but it's structural. It's not having to actually do with what hormones you have or what.
Yeah, I know. See. So in this view, sex was male, female, and gender was blue, pink.
Right. Yes.
Gotcha.
In Money's view, it had more to do with self-identity. So there are these terms floating around, the division first invented by Money, but given quite a different meaning by Gail Rubin. So, and the Gail Rubin point of view was used by feminist psychologists and sociologists mostly in the 70s and 80s to try to disarticulate where sex differences came from. So if someone did a study of, I don't know, that, okay, that boys were scoring better on math tests than girls. And then someone would say, but girls take fewer math courses than boys. And so that would be a gender thing. But then someone might say, and then someone would publish a study saying, well, girls take fewer math courses than boys because they're less interested in math. And maybe that's in their brain and an interest that derives from their neurobiology. And so that would be a sex thing. And people would go back and forth trying to take apart a known difference and trying to understand where it came from. And so some people would argue much more for cultural components to it and others much more for biological components to it. Now, along comes me and a bunch of other people who are doing feminist theory in the 90s and in the 2000s, who are starting to look at the ways in which the body itself changes in response to culture. So, and physiologically changes. So I published this paper in, I don't know, sometime in the 2000s called The Bare Bones of Sex, in which I looked at bone biology in the literature, and I showed and pointed out that, first of all, the bones of an adult aren't a permanent structure. Your skeleton turns over completely about every 10 years, the complete exchange. And as it turns over, it takes on new form that's a response to the activities that the body is doing. So the bones of a tennis player who's left-handed in their forearm are thicker than their right forearm. The bones of Hasidic Jewish adolescent boys who never go outdoors or never get sunshine, never get vitamin D, are as fragile as the bones of an old an older woman. They tend to get osteoporosis, in other words, because they're not doing athletic activity and they get no outside stimulus from vitamin D. So you see how the culture of being a Hasid in that case changes the structure of the bones of these young Hasidic men. So it's a culture, a religious culture in this place, having actual physical effects on the body. And so do you call that gender? It's the body, it's the bones. Do you call it sex? It's the body, it's the bones. Or do you call it gender? It's a culture. And so I started calling it sex gender. And then more recently, people have been calling it gender sex. And I'm accepting that reversal for two reasons. One is that I actually think most of what we want to call sex differences is gender sex. So I'm giving greater emphasis to gender, where I mean by that a physiological feedback from gendered structures and gender differentiated behaviors onto the body to produce, in a kind of feedback loop, a body that's different. And there are some things, I think, but relatively few, that are pure sex. And there are some things that are pure culture or gender. So now I'm using that term more, the gender sex, more.
It's interesting because, obviously I think teasing these things apart is quite important, especially because it can have real world implications for individual people, but also for us as social creatures. But at the same time, I guess I just kind of walk around with this assumption all the time that sort of the nature and the nurture of it all are so inextricably linked, that there's so much feedback that you almost can't say one is one and the other is the other.
No, you can't. I totally agree with you about that. The kind of an analysis that I use, which is a more developmental dynamic analysis, I often say, and again, it's not original to me, but I often say that we are simultaneously 100% nature and 100% nurture.
That
is, you can't have the one without the other. So even if you're studying a natural effect, some effect that you want to call a sex effect, you can't study it outside of a context. And that's even true down to the level of a cell. So the way a particular enzyme activates is going to look different in a bone cell than it is in a muscle cell. Because the whole internal cellular context is different. And you scale that up to behavior, and you're dealing with something quite complicated and also really inextricable.
Absolutely. So where is it then that these, because I hear all the time when individuals are pushing back against this conversation about gender or sex, I think sometimes the terms are conflated and they get intermingled and they get used incorrectly.
Oh, terribly conflated. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And lots of times I'll hear from, these individuals, the same types of people who love to call me a social justice warrior on the internet, will say things like, how are there 26 genders? Who came up with that? That's insane. And I'm like, first, A, where are you getting that weird number? And B, why does this bother you so much that some people could be intersex? I don't understand.
Right. It takes all kinds of personalities to make a world.
Yeah.
And some people want their boundaries more clearly set than others.
Yeah. Do you know where that number's coming from? They say 26 all the time.
No, I have no idea.
I feel like that must just be some sort of weird propaganda thing that,
I don't. I mean, I don't know if you ever read, I cite it in one of my books, Martine Rothblatt, who's a kind of interesting person, transgender, invented and runs a technology business, quite successful. And she wrote, you should Google her, you'll find her interesting. She wrote this book in which she comes up with a theory of permutations of different things that go into gender. And she comes up with, I don't know, some number like 232. So, I mean, if someone had quoted that, I would say, oh, it's from Martine Rothblatt's book. But the other number, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I guess that maybe, you know, there's an article that was read, or maybe
probably
a popular write-up of a, that happens a lot too. There's an article that gets through review, and then a journalist writes it up, and then they make their own
interpretations. Have you ever just Googled the phrase 36 genders or 36 sexes?
26.
26, so whatever.
26 sexes.
I bet if you Googled it, you'd come up with.
Yeah, some sort of. Yeah, we've got 58 for the Facebook users.
Right. Right.
We've got,
I mean, it's kind of fascinating, but
it is. No. And the thing is, the truth is, you know, I think using a critical point of view, like none of those numbers are the number. There is no the number because it's a continuum.
Right. Nor is the five that I made up kind of tongue in cheek when I started writing about intersex the number.
And what were those five?
Oh, well, I started writing about intersex because I was critiquing the medical literature on it. And also trying to just get the idea that there's more than just two out there in the world, sort of break away from binary ways of thinking. But the older literature had said, well, there's males, there's females, there's what they called true hermaphrodites, which historically got defined as people who have one testis and one ovary. And then there are what they call male pseudo-hermaphrodites and female pseudo-hermaphrodites. And the male pseudo were, quote, supposed to be, I'm doing air quotes as I say this, supposed to be male, but something developmentally odd. So there happened, so they were XY, but they developed with a vagina. That's, as say, in androgen insensitivity. Or an example for a female pseudohermaphrodites is someone who has a syndrome called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and they can end up with very masculinized external genitalia, but have ovaries and a uterus and two X chromosomes. So the medical push was to put them back into, try to make them back into either pure male or pure female categories. So I was describing the kinds of surgery that was done to try and essentially hide the presence of intersex. And critiquing it in one of my earlier books. And I wrote this article called The Five Sexes in the early 90s, and it got a lot of play. It still does, actually, where I just said, well, I just made a joke, essentially. I said, well, there's five. There's males, there's females, there's true hermaphrodites that I named them herms, and female pseudo-hermaphrodites who I called firms. And then male pseudo-hermaphrodites, who I called merms. So I made that as a kind of tongue-in-cheek way of writing something funny that was also serious. And I guess one lesson I learned was never try irony, because because so many people then took it literally and believe that's what I think is true. And so some people argued that, no, they're more, and some people argued, no, they're less. And I'm like, you know, give me a break. It's, you know, it's just a different way of trying to conceptualize or think about the world.
Yeah, it's just a new categorization that's been imposed upon something that just is. Like, all we're talking about is how we talk about things that just are.
Right.
And I think sometimes people get so stuck on how we communicate about them that they actually forget that these things exist. You know, I think there are plenty of people in this country, possibly in the world, who are incredibly uncomfortable with the idea that not everybody is exactly like they are.
No, I think that's true. And getting back to the original question of sort of why are people so freaked out, I do go back to the fact that there are some people who are comfortable with kind of open-ended structure, and some people who really like everything sewn up really nicely, and that those people don't like it when other people start, you know, cutting the threads a little, tearing the fabric a little, however that metaphor works best. But
yeah, I mean, I think it even goes back to some of the underlying arguments against LGBTQ equality, which for me, they're just so hard to understand, even from a religious perspective. I was raised quite religious. I'm an atheist now. But even when I try to put my headspace back into where I was as a child or into my parents' minds, this idea that somehow two people who are the same sex, getting married, having children, raising a family, being citizens, contributing to society, is in any way threatening or undermining of a heterosexual relationship. It just, I physically have a hard time grasping it.
Yeah, I do too, obviously, but.
Yeah. And I think that just applies, you can just further that kind of conversation when it comes to an individual, you know, thinking that somebody who is transgender, for example, should not have the same basic human rights. So, you know, those are political conversations. And of course, when we talk about somebody being transgender, maybe you can define that clearly in case if anybody listening is like still kind of confused by the terms.
Well, again, it's a term that's changed meaning in the last however many years, three, four decades, where it when it first became a word that some people were aware of in the 1950s, the term was transsexual, and it literally meant someone who believed they were born in the wrong body. So it literally meant someone who thought they were a female. So they had the gender identity, as money understood it, of a female, but they were born in a male body or vice versa, and who sought what was called at the time sex change operation, so that they wanted to make their body and their identity congruous. That term has morphed into transgender, which covers a lot of people, kinds of people. It covers the 1950s transsexual person, but it also covers a lot of people whose identity doesn't match their body to some degree or other. And some of those people, and not all of the people necessarily seek, for example, complete bodily transformation. They live in different kinds of mixed gender spaces and may refer to themselves as transgender. It may be that mostly they dress a different way, or they may take hormones but not have genital surgery, or any, you know, there's a lot of different ways of expressing that idea. And so the idea of transgender has supplanted that earlier notion of transsexual, which carried a much more sort of straightforward biological connotation.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when I think sometimes about the labels that we use societally, and maybe this is still a scientific conversation that I'm about to open up, or maybe this is much more of a social or political conversation, although again, I think the two are inextricably linked. You almost see discomfort sometimes with individuals who feel as if they are being put upon to have to keep up with a political correctness that is either complicated to them, or that, you know, somehow, why should I have to be treading lightly, or why should I have to be respectful of your choice to invent a new label and then require individuals to approach you the correct way? And so I say this when I'm talking about things that I think a lot of the general public doesn't understand. When somebody says, for example, I'm gender fluid, or when somebody says, I am queer, and people say, I don't know what that means. And I guess my answer to that is always like, why don't you just ask them? Like, you know, because it might mean something different to this person who identifies as queer than that person over there who identifies as queer. Why don't you just ask them what they mean by that?
The analogy, well, a couple of things. First of all, I think that notion of why should I have to take the trouble to understand what's going on really is a question about how much any one individual wants to engage with a diverse community. It's also maybe a question of how put upon someone feels in their own life. So someone who's just struggling to make ends meet and sort of survive in their day-to-day activities may not be in a position to think about anyone else's needs. And they can operate within their own framework, but someone says, hey, there's this other framework, you have to change your framework. And they're like, I got to find a way to get bread for my table. So there's that. And then there's a bigger question of people who are perfectly well off and who are not under that kind of huge strain may just be comfortable in their own little nest. It does take effort to reach out to be part of a bigger community. And so it's, you know, so they're annoyed if some large group comes and says, my needs aren't being met. You need to respond to my needs because it involves changing your life. And that is part of a social movement. I mean, for me, I go back to my early childhood or my whole childhood in which there were changing norms about how we referred to African Americans, starting with, you know, calling people colored in the 30s and 40s and 50s, changing then the progressive thing for a while was to say Negro and not colored. And, you know, I grew up in a progressive family. And so we very dutifully started correcting people when they said colored people instead of Negro. And then, of course, came the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement. And at some point, Negro became an offensive term and African-American became the preferred term. And it can be hard to get used to at first. But at some point you say, well, you know, it's not up to me to decide what the right term is. It's up to the people, the political movement in question to decide what the right term is. And then you either accept it or you don't. But if you want to be in community communication with them, then you have to accept it.
And it's like, take a few minutes to exercise a little bit of empathy, right? On a day-to-day basis, back when the African-American community were mostly referred to as Negroes, you know, you might say, okay, well, that's the progressive thing to do. That's what we're doing. But we're not seeing the experiences of individuals where Negro is used as a derisive term, you know, like where, okay, this is the new label. And now somehow people are manipulating that to be insulting. And then it takes on the new connotation, which is it evolves, obviously. But when you're outside of that community, when that really is an outgroup to you and you are keeping with kind of your tribal lines, you don't see those small and pernicious evolutions taking place on a daily basis. So then All of a sudden you go, why is there this huge shift? It's like, it wasn't quick. It wasn't overnight. It's been happening for years.
Right. No, that's a really good point. I think that's right. So yeah, it can be hard for anyone who's outside of a group to simply say, oh, now you want me to say this. But then, as I said, if we're committed to community and to having a functioning social fabric, then part of our being committed to it means we, as you say, we have to ask people.
Yeah.
Why is this change happening? What does it mean to you? And ask ourselves then, should we make the effort to make this change in ourselves?
Absolutely. And in my experience, I think when you approach individuals with an open mind, with kindness and genuine questioning, you know, you say like, I genuinely, like, I'm not sure what that means. And I want to make sure that I don't, you know, commit any faux pas. I'm really interested. Like, what does it mean when you use that term? People aren't offended by that. Like, you don't
have to
be so afraid of offending people. Just ask.
No, I agree with you. I think that's right.
But it is interesting, just for people kind of on the outside looking in at a movement, the inner workings of it can feel a little bit like magic. And that's why I think the scientific approach, the endeavors that individuals like yourself and your colleagues take on are so incredibly important, because that provides a robust literature so that individuals who maybe culturally are removed from these groups of individuals can be up to speed, can be up to date, and they can really understand what's happening behind the scenes.
Right. Good.
Yeah, no, really, it is important. And so maybe we can spend just a couple more minutes before we finish the show talking about what is happening behind the scenes. You mentioned a bit ago, and it's something that I've always found quite fascinating and quite a dark chapter, I think, in our history, this idea that early on with intersex individuals or, you know, hermaphrodite individuals, you know, the terminology may shift, or are both of those terms still used?
Well, yeah, and there's a third term, and each one of them is controversial, I have to say, in different groups, but there's a third term which the medical world is now using instead of those earlier terms, which is called disorders of sexual development.
So I could see that coming across as quite controversial.
So the medical world, and I'm of two minds about it. I understand why it's offensive, but also it puts sexual development on the same line as, say, heart development. I mean, because we have, when I teach embryology and I use a human embryology textbooks, if when I'm teaching heart development, there's always a section on disorders of the circulatory development. So it's sort of saying all systems have their regular functioning way of developing, where, and for the urogenital system, I'd say what regular functioning means is being able to urinate properly so that you don't aren't poisoned by your own bodily fluids, and hopefully being having the possibility of reproduction. So, and then there's always arguments about, you know, what the, there's what I coined for one paper that I published, the idea of a platonic ideal. So the platonic ideal of a normal female includes someone who produces eggs that, and can at least have children. But of course, there are many perfectly good women in the world who don't have fertile ovaries. And so at what point do we draw that line of what's normal and what's not normal? That's a social decision.
And also, is the word normal itself even loaded? Like, even when you first started this conversation, were saying
totally
regular. And we think of normal as falling within a normal distribution. Like, the word normal has statistical meaning, but of course,
it has statistical meaning. And then in the medical world, it has that more judgmental meaning.
Yeah, exactly. Of, you know, and in society, I think at large, it has a very judgmental meaning. Like, what? I'm not normal? How could you say that?
Right. So the same word gets used in many different ways. And there's always this sliding from one to the other. So that's why I think there are problems with disorders of sexual development. And then on the other hand, it allows the medical world to say, all right, we have this child in front of us and we can try to decipher what exactly has led to them being, being born with ovaries, but a penis. And then we can decide, knowing that, are there actual health, by which I mean, in this case, survival issues involved that need treatment? Or is this a condition that a child can be raised with perfectly happily? Is medical intervention warranted or not? And that can be done by looking at each individual case by case and genesis by genesis, cause by cause.
And of course, that has real world practical implications beyond just, you know, what kinds of decisions should we make right now? Because we work within a very structured and very evolved society. So, you know, if this is considered a disorder in a textbook, for example, or like a disorder in the DSM, does that mean now that the insurance companies will cover certain types of quote unquote
yes.
treatment? You know, all
right.
that actually matters for an individual person.
It does
person.
Matter. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's absolutely right. Yeah. The DSM as a way of treating, of getting any kind, treatment in certain areas. It's a whole, I'm sure if you haven't already done a whole podcast on it, it's an easy one to do an hour on.
Yeah, that's probably true. Like, you know, we think of gender identity disorder, for example, which
right.
I'm just about to start learning on the 5 because I was on the DSM-4 TR for years and I haven't really taken the time to look. So I haven't seen yet all of the changes in the 5. Has that been updated? Is that no longer a disorder or is it still in there?
It is still in there. Its definitions have changed. There's a lot written about it in scientific publications. If you ever want to follow up on it, I can give you the names of people who worked on it and who have, you know, really smart things to say about how the new terms came into being and what they are. I haven't tried to master it myself since I'm not a practicing psychologist. So I can't myself be helpful, but I know where to look and where to read if I needed to figure it out.
So of course, as sometimes happens, technology fails us, and our original recording got cut off. So we are picking up the very end of our conversation through Skype, which is why it sounds just a little bit different. Where were we when we were cut off? Oh, we were talking about the changes in the DSM. Basically, really, the point was that sometimes these labels and these conventions actually have real-world consequences for these individuals who are, let's say, you know, a baby is born with, like you were saying, ovaries and a penis. Physicians might need to make decisions then about what is best for the health of the child. And an obviously more complicated decision is what is best psychologically for the child.
Right. And the problem with the old way of dealing with intersex has been that physicians were, how shall I put this, a little rigid and arrogant about how much they knew, they thought they knew about what was best psychologically. And it was because they came into the treatment situation with this idea that the only possible psychological spaces for someone to be was either a classic Platonic male or, you know, I'm sorry, Aristotelian male or classic Aristotelian female, you know, just everything in place. And yeah, that no one could exist outside of that situation.
Yeah. And maybe I think I remember learning from you years ago that historically certain operations may have been undertaken simply because they were easier. Like it might be easier to remove a penis than it would be to remove the ovaries, or it might be less invasive or something like that. So just certain decisions were made that you have no way of knowing how the gender identity is going to develop later in life.
Right. And I think there was a period in which people were sure they knew which way gender was going to develop, or they were sure that it could be controlled simply by raising a child a certain way. And what's clear about gender identity is that it's not clear. We can't predict. And what has to happen is that the individual child at some point has to develop an identity that they let us know about, that we figure out with them, and that then other medical decisions get made around that. As I say, except for if there have to be earlier decisions made to save the life of the child, which sometimes there does.
Yeah, and you would think that as an individual who had those experiences as an infant, that that would be fed into your schema later in life. You would know that that were the case. Oh, this had to happen because otherwise it would have died. So I am appreciative of that and I'm working with it.
Right, exactly.
And I feel like there is so much more to learn from you, but I also don't want to keep you the rest of the day. So I was hoping that maybe I could close this episode by asking you the same two questions that I ask all of my guests on the podcast. And they're kind of big picture questions. So are you ready for that?
Okay.
All right.
All right.
So the first one is, when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you right now, you know, it could be the future of you, your life, your family's life, the future of your work, the future of humanity as a whole. Number one, what is the thing that kind of keeps you up the most at night, worries you the most, preoccupies your time? But number two, on the flip side, so we can end on a more positive note, what are you most hopeful and optimistic and excited about?
So the things that keep me up at night are really that right now, the daily news. I mean, I worry about climate change. I worry about nuclear war, which I wasn't worrying about 5 years ago in quite the same way. I mean, but I watch the international situation right now. And, you know, I think something terrible could happen.
Absolutely.
And I do worry about, you know, all of the negative things having to do with the political situation. I worry about new immigrants. I worry about racial violence. I mean, all of these things that I'm seeing right now are very disturbing. And on the positive side, I can hearken back to comments you made earlier in this conversation, which is that there has been enormous change. And even though it feels like we're going backwards in terms of things that I just assumed everybody agreed on, like that women should have access to birth control. I mean, that birth control itself should have re-entered the public discourse seems astonishing to me. But I don't think it's real, because I think that I can't imagine the generation of women who are still fertile putting up with a loss of birth control. I mean, I just think that's the positive side of it. I think the younger generations are more open and more inclusive in many, many ways. I think that we've had, you know, positive change in the scientific world and the medical world. I think there are lots of good things have happened and will continue to happen. I just think in some cases we're going to have to struggle to maintain and struggle to move forward.
Hear, hear is what I'll say to that. I am right there with you. And I think that a lot of people listening to this podcast feel the same way. So Anne, can I just thank you again for joining me? This was such an enlightening chat.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed the last time we chatted, and I've enjoyed this.
Excellent. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.